Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
And we're back studying the Torah portions. This week, we're looking at the portion Vayishlach, which means, and he sent. The reading this week is from Genesis 32:4 or 32:3 in Christian translations through 36:43. We've already read the portion ahead of time, so if you'd like to read it as well, why don't you go ahead and pause the video and do that right now, and then we'll get into discussing.
Vayishlach tells how Jacob is reconciled to his brother Esau, and he returns to the land of his fathers, Abraham and Isaac. In Canaan, Jacob has struggles with the Canaanites, has a new son, and buries his wife Rachel and his father Isaac.
So this portion begins with Jacob just having re-entered the land of Canaan after having been gone for some 20 years. And his first order of business is to make peace with his brother Esau. Esau and Jacob had had a huge falling out when we last saw them because Jacob had stolen the blessing from Esau that his father Isaac was intending to give to Esau. And Jacob actually had to flee Canaan because Esau wanted to kill him. So now it's 20 years later, Jacob's coming back to the land and he doesn't want there to still be trouble between him and his brother. So he immediately starts arranging this massive gift-giving campaign to Esau, sending messengers ahead of him, where he tells his messengers to refer to Esau as my master or my lord, and Jacob's constantly calling himself your servant. So he's just trying to be really humble and trying to do everything that he can to reconcile with Esau.
Yeah, he's acting very submissive. Mm. Isaac had given Jacob all the blessings to make him greater than Esau, and now that Jacob's finally coming back and he's been blessed and he's great, he's still scared of Esau.
Yeah.
And so he wants to make himself low and humble before Esau, so Esau's not jealous and tries to kill him and everything he has.
And on top of just the general trying to appease Esau, Jacob also prays to God. He says, you're the God of my father Abraham and the God of my father Isaac, and you promised me that I would return to my land and I would prosper. And he admits, he says, I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. So Jacob is not only humble toward Esau, but he's also being humble toward God. Jacob wasn't an altogether righteous man, but God showed him his favor anyway. And Jacob is recognizing that, and he's asking God, even though I'm not worthy, please continue to show me faithfulness.
Yeah. Jacob knows that he's not a perfect guy, but he knows God appeared to him and promised him that he would protect him and bring him back. And he's calling on God to be faithful to that promise. And so while he's doing all he can to protect his family and his household from Esau, he's also leaving it in the hands of God because he knows God's the only one who can protect him.
Exactly.
In addition to trying to appease Esau, he creates a plan B of sorts where he takes all of his flocks and herds and people and splits them into two camps.
And he puts a distance between them, so that way he's like, if Esau attacks one, at least I'll have the other camp.
Right. And so he's showing he's legitimately scared that he's going to
get murdered.
Yeah. But he's being prudent, doing all he can to protect what he has.
But still trusting God anyway.
Right. So when Jacob has done all this,
Made all the preparations,
he sends all that he has across the river, including his family, and he's left alone. When he's there alone in the middle of the night, waiting for the inevitable arrival of his brother, something very strange happens. A man appears and wrestles with him until daybreak. And it doesn't really say how or why the man appeared. Mm. And it doesn't give much explanation for Jacob's reaction. Just that they're wrestling until daybreak.
Exactly.
And in the course of the fight, the man touches Jacob's hip and puts it out of place.
Yeah.
So now he's got a limp.
He's got a dislocated hip, yeah. But he's still fighting this guy. And the guy says to Jacob, "Let me go. It's already almost dawn." And Jacob says, "I won't let you go until you bless me."
It's crazy because, like we've said before, Isaac's already given him all the blessings.
Mm.
There's like nothing left to bless. And yet, Jacob is still fighting for more blessing.
Right. And it's at this point that the man asks Jacob what his name is. Jacob says, I'm Jacob. And then he says, "What's your name?" And the man says, "Why do you ask for my name?" But then he says, "Your name isn't going to be Jacob anymore. Your name is going to be Israel." Israel, or Yisrael in Hebrew, means he wrestles or he strives with God. And the explanation for why he gets this new name is because Jacob has striven with God and with men and has prevailed. And then the man does bless Jacob like he's been trying to get him to do all night. And then Jacob says, "I've seen God face to face." And he names the place Peniel, which means the face of God. So even though this is like a really weird story and at first it's not really clear who this man is, it's made very clear by the end here that the man that Jacob was struggling with was actually God himself. In fact, there's a verse in Hosea 12 where it's kind of recounting the story of Jacob, and it says, "In the womb he took his brother by the heel, and in his maturity he contended with God. Yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed." So sometimes things get a little bit mixy where it's talking about this is God and this is an angel. Yeah. So this was an angel, this was God, but whatever the case, he faced God face to face, and he survived. He wrestled with God and he won. This interaction sort of defines the nation of Israel's relationship with God in a way where, yes, there's a lot of contention there, there's fighting, and yet God still blesses Israel. And it also shows a certain closeness that Israel and God have. No one else interacts with God this way. It's bizarre, but God puts up with us. And in the end, he does bless us. It's just a really strange story, but it's basically the culmination of everything that we've seen Jacob go through in his life so far, all of the trying to get the promise, trying to get the birthright, and now he's striving with God himself, "Give me the blessing."
In the last portions, we saw how he struggled with Esau over the birthright and the blessing. And then we saw how he struggled with Laban for his wives and his flock and everything that he now has.
Mm.
And now he's preparing to struggle with Esau again for survival. And so God says, "Now it's time to strive with me." And Jacob won, and we'll see that he's not going to have to strive with Esau now.
Right.
Because Jacob has prevailed.
Now, one last thing that I feel like I need to mention about this story is that a lot of people look at this story and they think that the man who wrestles with Jacob must be pre-incarnate Jesus, because it's God being in the form of a man, doing something pretty significant to biblical history. And I don't feel like there's anything in this passage that specifically indicates that there's some sort of Jesus here or anything like that. It's a kind of weird concept, but there's actually an episode of the Biblically Correct podcast that's all about the concept of a pre-incarnate Jesus, and it does discuss this passage briefly. So if you want to look into that aspect of things, you can go check out that podcast. But we aren't going to really get into that today.
So in the morning, Esau arrives, and Jacob gets ready to meet him. And he gets all his children and their mothers and divides them. And then Jacob goes out in front of them all and begins walking toward Esau. And as he approaches, he bows repeatedly seven times so that Esau won't be angry with him when he arrives. But it actually says not only was Esau not upset, but he actually ran to meet Jacob and embraced him and kissed him and wept.
Both of them wept. It's a touching moment. It's a happy reunion. There's no anger here. Jacob is showing contrition, and Esau is showing, I still love you. There's no enmity here now, like possibly for the first time in their lives.
Yeah, after 20 years, Esau is not upset with Jacob.
Mm.
And Jacob's not haughty toward Esau.
He's not trying to take anything from Esau. Finally, things are peaceful between the two brothers.
And Esau says, what's with all the messages you sent? What's with all the gifts? And Jacob says, they were for you. And
Esau's like, I don't need those. I still have plenty of stuff. And Jacob says, but no, you need to take it. It's for you. And Jacob ends up getting Esau to accept these gifts, even though Esau didn't want them. So this story here reminded me of back when Abraham was trying to buy a tomb for his wife Sarah back a few videos ago. Jacob is again showing the generosity of his family, like firm generosity, like, I am going to give you something. You cannot get away with not getting something.
But I mean, this is more than generosity here.
Mm.
Jacob wants Esau to accept this as a sign of accepting Jacob.
Mm.
Jacob specifically says, if I found favor in your sight, then accept my present. So Jacob's saying, I know you have enough, but if you accept this present, then it's showing that you're favorable to me. It's showing the reconciliation that we've got.
It's kind of like a sign where we've seen when people make a covenant or when God makes a covenant, there's a sign there to show the surety of that. Basically, Jacob is saying, take this gift to show that we're okay.
Right. And so Esau says, okay, fine. So now that the two of them are reconciled, Esau says, let's journey together. I'll lead the way.
Mm.
But Jacob says, all my flocks are going to hinder me and my children are going to hinder me. I'm going to go
slowly. That fast, yeah.
Yeah. So you go on ahead. I'll catch up and come to your land in Seir when I get the chance, because they're going to be slow. And Esau says, okay, fine, but I'll leave you like an escort or something. And Jacob says, really? No need.
It's so funny. They're both trying to be super nice to each other.
Yeah.
And every time, Jacob still wins out.
Yeah,
so
Jacob's still winning, even though now it's a niceness contest.
It's like no matter what Jacob tries to do, he always wins. But then at this point, Jacob settles in Shechem, which is a city in Canaan. And there, he buys some land in Canaan. And then he sets up an altar and he calls it El Elohe Yisrael, which means God, the God of Israel. So this right here also reflects something that we saw back with Abraham all the way in Genesis 12 and 13, where basically Abraham had left Canaan because of a famine. And when he comes back, he builds an altar and calls on the name of God. And also, when Abraham needs to bury his wife Sarah, he purchases a field in Canaan. So I'm just seeing the same things that happened with Abraham and some of the things that happened with Isaac, they're now happening with Jacob as well.
This land that Jacob buys here actually ends up being a burial place.
Oh, really?
Not for himself, but for his son Joseph.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when after 400 years, Joseph's bones are brought back from
They're buried Egypt. Here in Shechem.
They're buried here in Shechem. It specifically says, for the bones of Joseph, they buried them at Shechem, in the piece of land that Jacob bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem.
Wow.
It's the very same spot.
Huh.
It's where Joseph is buried, and it becomes an inheritance of Joseph's descendants.
That's really interesting. So, more parallels there, where it becomes a burial. I mean, he wasn't buying it as a tomb here, but still, it's just an interesting
It still
parallel.
Becomes an Israeli family tomb.
So as the story moves on in chapter 34, we now hear about something that happens to Jacob's only daughter, Dinah. So this Canaanite named Shechem ends up actually raping Dinah. It says that Shechem was deeply attracted to Dinah and wanted to marry her, so he he raped her first, though. So after he rapes Dinah, he then has the audacity to go into Jacob and say, I want to marry your daughter. And more than that, I want you to intermarry with us. You take our daughters, and we'll take your daughters, and we'll intermarry. And it actually says we'll become one people. So basically, these Canaanites aren't content to have Jacob living in the land and the Canaanites living in the land, and they're separate. They want to mingle and become one people. They want to intermarry, specifically so that Shechem can have Dinah as a wife. So obviously, Jacob and his sons are extremely angry about this. They say, it says that this is a disgraceful thing in Israel that should not be done. So this was a horrible thing that they did, and then they're saying, intermarry with us. I just wanted to talk about this concept here of intermarriage, because it's basically they're saying, take daughters from us and give your daughters to us, and we'll exchange freely, you'll live with us, we'll be one people. And then when they're talking about it later among themselves, it says their livestock and their property and all the animals will be ours. So basically, this is showing, we've already talked about intermarriage a few times in previous videos, about how it's against the promises because it's mingling with the other nations. But here it's showing really vividly what would happen if Israel and Jews intermarry a lot with the nations around them. Basically, they become one people with the other nations. And it's not that the other nations become Israel. It's that Israel, all their stuff ends up going to the Gentiles. And Israel loses everything. Because they're essentially losing their definition as an ethnic group. Part of the covenant with Israel is that he chose us from among the peoples. So if we become one people with some other ethnic group, then suddenly we aren't a visible, identifiable nation that you can point to and say that's God's chosen people.
So when the sons of Jacob say, yeah, we'll agree to intermarry with you if you all get circumcised, mm-hmm. they're actually being underhanded. They have a plan.
Right.
And Shechem and his people fall for it. They agree to it. They all get circumcised. And afterwards, they're very sore. all the men in the whole city are going to be in pain. And two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, take the city by surprise while they're in the middle of recovering and kill all the males.
They kill all the men, and then they basically ransack the city. They take a bunch of loot and plunder. They take the women and children.
Including reclaiming Dinah from Shechem.
Because apparently they actually went through with it, and Dinah actually did go to be Shechem's wife, apparently.
For 3 days.
But then at this point, Jacob calls Simeon and Levi and says, you've brought trouble on me. You basically just ruined my reputation with all the Canaanites.
Yeah.
Now I'm living among a bunch of enemies.
Yeah. Jacob did not know their plan. Jacob did not approve of their plan. Jacob was upset with his sons. Mm. But his sons continued to
defend themselves.
Yeah.
They were like, what else were we supposed to do?
Yeah. As far as Jacob's sons were concerned, this vengeance was necessary. Mm. But Jacob was not happy with it. Jacob is so upset with them that much later when he's on his deathbed, his final words for them will be...
Curses. They're violent.
He says, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords.
Oof.
Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel.
So this was not something that is just like, it was bad, I'm angry at you, and then we'll leave it at that. This was bad. This was really wrong, and it had lasting consequences.
Not only Simeon and Levi, but their whole tribes will have to bear the consequences of this when they're scattered in the land of Israel.
Right. Levi gets an inheritance of just a bunch of cities all throughout Israel, and Simeon actually gets an inheritance inside of Judah's inheritance.
Whereas all the other brothers will get land inheritances, Simeon and Levi's inheritances are both in the middle of everyone else's inheritances. Mm. They don't get a large spot that's, this is where we can live. Mm. They'll always have to be surrounded. And that's the punishment
for violence and anger.
So after all of this, God appears to Jacob again and tells him, go back to Bethel. Mm. And when you get there, make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. God is specifically hearkening back to all those years ago when Jacob was fleeing the land of Canaan, and he stopped at Bethel, and he saw the vision of the ladder, and he said, this is the house of God. Mm. And that's where God first made a promise to Jacob.
Yeah.
Also, we noted back then that Jacob made a promise in return to God. The words of that promise were, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God.
Mm. And so basically, this is God saying, hey, Jacob,
I kept up my end of the bargain.
You said, I'm going to be your God now.
Right.
And Jacob's response is to tell his household, put away the foreign gods which are among you. So we'd seen when Jacob left Laban, his wife Rachel had actually stolen Laban's idols and kept them. So there was obviously idolatry still going on in Jacob's house. But here, Jacob's like, no more. We only have one God now.
Jacob's fulfilling his vow. Mm. He gathers all the idols that anyone had in his whole house, and he buries them under a tree. And then they set off to Bethel. And when they get there, he builds an altar.
He builds an altar and he calls it El Beit El, which means God of Bethel, God of the house of God. But basically, it's hearkening back to, I'm building this altar to the God who appeared to me here.
This is to the God that I saw at Bethel because he fulfilled his promise. And interestingly, as Jacob is journeying to Bethel, it says, a terror from God fell upon the cities that were around them, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So Jacob had been worried after the incident with Shechem that all the Canaanites were going to treat him as enemies. Mm. But it says that
they're afraid of him.
Yeah, God sent terror on them so that they didn't mess with Jacob.
Right.
So even though, unlike Abraham and Isaac, Jacob is now in a land where he is hostile to the Canaanites. Mm. God is still showing protection to him in the middle of the land, even as the people around him are hostile to him. So it's showing this renewed and continued commitment of Jacob to God and God to Jacob. And in accordance with that commitment, God appears to Jacob again afterwards and says to him again, you will no longer be called Jacob, but Israel will be your name, hearkening back to the time when he wrestled with God.
Right.
And so now he vows to Israel, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, a nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come from your own body. And the land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac I will give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you. So it's the same covenant that he'd given to Abraham and to Isaac. He's
confirming that to Jacob now. And basically, everything here, going back to Bethel, calling him Israel, bringing back Abraham and Isaac. Basically, God is bookending and saying, everything that we've read about Abraham and Isaac leading up to this point, it is now being confirmed to Israel. This is where the promise culminates. Israel is who will get the promised nation. And it's a company of nations because there are going to be 12 tribes. And they're going to split into two separate kingdoms and such, which will eventually be reunited one day. But everything that God has promised to Abraham and then passed on to Isaac is going to come specifically through Israel.
God had already made these promises to Jacob, but now he's making them to Israel, which they're the same person.
But at the same time, it hits different because Israel is the name that the whole nation will be known for. Israel is from whom the Messiah comes. Israel is God's chosen people. And the sons of Israel are God's chosen people.
And like you had said before, Esau was renamed Edom. And his entire nation came to be defined by the act in which he got his name.
Which was to sell his birthright.
Right. And like you said, that was a dishonorable consequence that all the descendants had to bear. But here, God is attaching the name Israel to the promise. So,
when we bear the name of Israel, we are bearing this promise. And then after God made this promise with him, Jacob then also harkens back to what happened before, and he sets up a pillar and he pours a drink offering on it, and he names the place Bethel again. So, just like how God is reaffirming everything that he'd done up until this point, Jacob is reaffirming his end of the deal. So after all this, it says that Jacob and his house ended up journeying toward Ephrath, or it's actually Bethlehem. And on the way, Jacob's wife Rachel goes into labor. Just to repeat what we read in the last portion, Rachel was the wife that Jacob loved most. And she'd only had one child up until this point, Joseph. But now she has another son and she dies in childbirth, giving birth to this son. So this son is Benjamin, Jacob's youngest son and Jacob's last son, making the last of the 12 tribes of Israel. So it just kind of sets the backdrop for Benjamin being a very special son to Jacob. And we'll see where that leads in following portions.
Both Joseph and Benjamin are very special to Jacob because they're the only sons of his wife Rachel, who he loved the most.
And there's also a one-verse story here that I need to bring up because it is brought up again later in Torah. But it says that Jacob's firstborn son, Reuben, defiles Jacob's concubine, Bilhah. So that's seriously messed up, and it actually ends up having consequences for Reuben, like we saw the consequences with Simeon and Levi. Later, we'll see that the consequence for Reuben is that he loses the birthright as the firstborn. We see that in 1 Chronicles 5:1, where it says that he was born first, but he didn't get the birthright and he wasn't enrolled as the firstborn. So, again, just showing evil behavior has long-term consequences, and there's no way to get around that.
And then the last of these little things that we're told is Jacob finally returns to his father Isaac. Isaac was already old and thinking he was about to die.
20 years ago.
Yeah, that was 20 years ago. So it's really remarkable that Jacob got to see his father again. Isaac actually lived a little longer than Abraham even.
Wow.
180 years.
That's a good long life.
Long enough to see his son again, to see his sons reunited, and to see Jacob back in the land of the promise.
And to see the 12 patriarchs that would bring about the 12 tribes of Israel.
Right. So just like Abraham, Isaac seeing a little of what's to come.
Right. A little more than Abraham saw.
Yeah. After this final reunion, Isaac dies. And Esau and Jacob come together to bury him. Again, parallels how before we saw Isaac and Ishmael came together to bury Abraham.
Right. Two brothers, the firstborn who had been passed over for the promise. There was contention, and then they come together and bury their father. More parallels.
But Isaac actually gets buried in the same family tomb where Sarah and Abraham had been buried.
Yeah, we'll read that later in the Torah.
It's definitely good to see that Esau and Jacob can come together to bury their father. And Esau's not trying to kill Jacob. It says, "Behold how good and how pleasant it is for brothers to dwell together in unity." Now that Jacob and Esau are reunited, it's pleasant.
Yeah. Certainly a breath of fresh air compared to what it was before.
It's good to see that that's the scene that Isaac leaves behind.
And so this portion wraps up in chapter 36 by just listing out all of Esau's descendants. So like we saw after Abraham was buried, where it goes through and it lists all of Ishmael's descendants, here we're seeing all of Esau's descendants listed. And there are a lot of descendants here, lots of chiefs, lots of kings, actually. There was a line of kings in Edom, Esau's descendants, that existed before the line of kings in Israel. And so, interestingly, this is further fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham that he would be the father of a multitude of nations. We're already seeing Ishmael went out and became nations, and now Edom is becoming nations. And we also see with the line of kings, God had promised to Abraham back in Genesis 17 that kings would go forth from Abraham. And so this is the first time that we read about kings coming from Abraham. And so we're already seeing that promise come to fruition, and it's actually coming through Esau. It'll also happen through Israel, obviously, as the ultimate fulfillment, but it's starting to come true here with Esau.
Even though Israel is the promised nation, Edom actually gets like a head start.
Yeah.
Because like God had promised to Abraham, Israel's going to have to be in another nation and be servitude for 400 years.
Mm.
And in that time, Edom's going to become a nation, have chiefs, have kings. By the time the people of Israel leave the land, they'll have to interact with the king of Edom.
Right. And interestingly, and this is jumping ahead a little bit, but it says that God commands Israel to not conquer Edom when they're on their way back toward the land because God gave the land of Seir to Edom. So Esau's descendants get an inheritance.
But what we see with Esau is parallel to some other things we've seen before. The first of which being Lot and Abraham, where Lot and Abraham were together in the land and they separated because they were too big and the land wasn't big enough for them. It specifically says he went into a land away from his brother Jacob because their possessions were too great for them to dwell together.
Mm.
So we see again, God is blessing both Jacob and Esau so much that they have to go their separate ways.
Mm.
And God gives a land to Esau to become that great nation, which also leads to the other parallel, which is that Esau had to go into a land away from his brother Jacob to become a nation, just like the other sons of Abraham, who Abraham gave gifts.
But then he sent them away to the east.
Right. So he sent them away so that they could become nations.
But the inheritance of the land of Canaan went to Isaac. And so in the same way, the land of Canaan is going to Jacob, which means Esau needs to go somewhere else. And like we saw with Ishmael, Esau isn't getting a raw deal here. Even though it seemed up until now, like there was going to be nothing for Esau, it's going to be all horrible for him because Jacob stole it all. No, God is still giving Esau plenty. He has lots of descendants. He has his own nation. Yes, that nation will contend with Israel. All sorts of nations contend with Israel. But God hasn't forgotten Esau.
Yeah. Esau is one of the fulfillments of the promise to Abraham of there being many nations.
Mm.
And God gives him a lot of stuff and gives him a land in which to settle. Like you said, Esau has a sort of inheritance. It's just outside of the land of Israel because God set aside that land for a special purpose, for his special people. I think the takeaway from this portion is seek peace rather than violence.
Mm.
Jacob sought to make peace with his brother, and he succeeded, and we saw how good that was. On the other hand, Jacob's sons, when they sought vengeance and violence, caused grief to their father, made him upset with them, and put the other surrounding people at odds with them. Paul exhorts us, if possible, so far as it is in you, be living in peace with all men. And Yeshua likewise says, happy are the peacemakers, because they will be called sons of God. Mm. So it is a very good thing to seek peace with your neighbor whenever you can. Peace with your neighbors, peace with your brother. And that doesn't mean don't fight for what's right. Sometimes you have to. Like Jacob, when he wrestled with God.
Yeah. And even fought with Esau to get him to accept the gift.
So there are times when it's good to fight for what's right. But if you can, pursue peace, because that's far better than fighting.
That wraps up the portion of Vayishlach. Next week, we'll be discussing the portion of Vayeshev, so be sure to tune in for that. Thanks so much for watching. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit that notification bell to keep updated on new episodes. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation to help us make more videos like these. We would really appreciate it. Thanks so much for watching, and we'll see you next week. God bless.